WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Of all human endeavors, sports seems to get the lion's share of coverage. In schools, athletes get the lion's share of attention and encouragement. And yet, down through time, it is the arts that have enriched us. It is the arts through which cultures and civilizations leave their mark and through which they are remembered. Why then don't we pay more attention to contemporary artistic endeavors? In Charlotte, a coalition of media outlets is trying to do just that. WFAE is a member of that coalition, and we'll find out more about them later in the hour. First, a kind of celebratory look at one organization that for 30 years has been working to broaden our cinematic horizons by bringing films to town that would otherwise have gone unscreened and unseen. The Charlotte Film Society is celebrating 30 years by looking back on the films they've introduced us to and ahead to some of the films they are about to bring to town. And we're joined by Jay Morong, Programming Director at the Charlotte Film Society, a lecturer of film and theater in the Department of Theater at UNC Charlotte, and a theatrical video designer. Welcome to the program. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
And Richard Michel is back with us. Richard retired in 2008 from a 40-year career with the Charlotte Observer, the last 10 of which was spent in the newspaper's art and as the newspaper's art and architecture critic, author of the book Wet Wall Tattoos, Ben Long, and the Art of Fresco. He is now working on writing a memoir on growing up in Bayonne, New Jersey, and serves as one of the Film Society's stable of local experts who help lead discussions after film screenings. Good to see you again.
Thanks, Mike. Good to see you.
How's retirement?
Great.
Rick Timms is sitting over here.
Yeah.
Your old boss at The Observer.
Right.
You don't say that too loud. If you're celebrating 30 years, that means 1982.
That's correct.
Were you there at the beginning of this?
I was not. I was 2010. Well, a member before then, but 2010 when I actually got involved with the Charlotte Film Society.
And how long have you been involved, Richard?
I've attended their films through the years, but I haven't taken an active part in the organization.
Okay. What was the impetus for the birth of all of this?
Well, I guess I'll take that one. I mean, I think my understanding is that in the late 70s, early 80s, the Visual Light Theater was a movie theater.
Yeah.
And
hard to believe, isn't it?
It is hard to believe, and I wish it was again in some instances. But I guess they were programming alternative content, foreign films, independent films in the late 70s, early 80s. And by the early 80s, they decided basically it wasn't feasible. I don't know if the theater shut down at that point or they just changed their programming. And so a group of people in Charlotte basically got together and said, well, there's a void here. There is a void in Charlotte of foreign art house independent cinema that are just not coming to town. And so a group of people got together and formed a committee and a sort of a membership basis and then went over at the old Queen Park Theater, which was on Tryon, I believe. No, South Boulevard. And they just got together and basically said, we need to fill this void. And so that's how it started. They started with six films at the second half of the year. And then from then on, it's been a yearly thing of 12 or more films every year.
Define art house, foreign independent films as you see them. Because a lot of people who go to the movies only go to the movies when they find out that Batman has been released. Mm. So what makes these films different, more interesting, worthy of attention, worthy of devoting all the energy and time that the folks at the Film Society devote to bringing them here?
I mean, I think for me it just comes down to diversity. It just comes down to that they are a different perspective on universal themes that we all engage with in the arts. You know, we talk about that with theater. We talk about it with music. You know, when you're in a culture, the United States, in Charlotte, and you're engaging with just films that are of your culture, yes, you can get a lot from them. You can get a lot of thematic ideas and beliefs and values reinforced or challenged. But when you broaden that horizon to a more diverse perspective, a world perspective, if you will, especially with foreign films, you know, you're challenged by the fact that now you have a cultural barrier that you have to traverse as well. And I think that makes you work a little bit harder at trying to figure out what is a filmmaker actually saying with this work. But it's true of American independence as well. You know, these small, quirky films in the 70s and 80s, Jim Jarmusch and to one extent, you know, these filmmakers who are making small independent films that are very specific and culturally relevant to smaller communities, whether it's the gay and lesbian community, whether it's a African-American community, whether it's a Latino community, you know, those things open up people's horizons. And I think that's why it's important that you do bring a diverse collection of films. So Batman's great and people go and enjoy it and you can get a lot out of it. But at the same time, you know, open it up a little bit.
But you said something about what the filmmaker was saying, trying to find out what the filmmaker was saying. And I would think in a lot of Hollywood blockbuster films, the filmmaker isn't saying much of anything except that this is pure entertainment. Enjoy this for what it is.
I think that's probably true. I think, and you know, I think every I would probably venture to guess that most filmmakers are trying to say something, whether that has been muted to whatever degree. You know, Steven Spielberg makes Lincoln coming out. You know, right. He's clearly trying to say something. Yes. But at the same time, because of entertainment, because there's a lot of money at stake, because there's, you know, market share.
But if you put Daniel Day-Lewis in a film like Lincoln, you're almost making an art film because he's an artist. He really is.
Yeah, but you could – or you could make the reverse argument and say that, well, no, Daniel Day-Lewis is now just making big Hollywood cinema. Okay. He's sort of gradually moving up to a Hollywood star, and that's why he's winning Oscars now, and that's why he's, you know.
So in the 80s, when this started, there were very few options to find these films. As you say, the Visual Light kind of stopped doing it. There weren't very many other film chains that were willing to screen these films because the audience is much smaller than it would be for regular Hollywood films. TV didn't show them. We didn't have the plethora of satellite and cable channels that we have now. But now things have happened. We do have satellite. We do have cable. We have the Manor Theater. We have another chain, I think, in Ballantyne or elsewhere that shows lesser blockbuster-type films on a regular basis. Has that taken away from you? Has it freed you up to do even more esoteric programming? What has the impact of that been?
I think it's actually freed us up a little bit because I think, you know, Regal, the chain Regal Entertainment, they own basically 13 art house screens or cine art screens in Charlotte, Ballantyne, the Manor, and Park Terrace. But, you know, how many of those theaters actually show foreign films for the most part? Like, when you really look at the amount of films that actually come in there, there's not a lot of foreign products coming in there. There is some, but when you look at stuff that's playing in New York that the New York Times picks as their critics picks over and over again. When you look at things like what the Village Voice talks about in Los Angeles, films that play, these are a lot of films that probably would have played 30 years ago in an art house sitter, but now they don't because people say, well, you know, the Sessions, we have to put this independent film with Helen Hunt on a bunch of screens in Charlotte. So I think it has freed us up to be more diverse and sort of say people are looking for something different, and maybe we don't have to go down that road anymore. We don't have to bring in the American independence so much anymore or the documentaries as much because they're getting more play, and we can sort of go to a more diverse, eclectic sort of place.
Richard?
I think Jay said the right word when he talked about diversity. I mean, I know it's true in the visual arts, for instance, in addition to having museums, you need galleries. In addition to having galleries, you need spaces where artists can just put up work and show it. You need schools. You need the widest possible exposure. And when you have an industry that's so commercial, which is, I suppose, a benefit and a drawback, you need just to broaden the field to give a wider view, to give a richer experience. And that's what the Charlotte Film Society helps do. Mm-hmm.
In your years at the Observer, particularly as arts and architecture critic, you've watched, as we all have, the city grow and change, and not only grow in terms of the number of buildings and the kinds of buildings that have gone up downtown, but the number of people who have come here from different parts of the country and different parts of the world. And I would think that along with the growth, the appetite in this city for different forms of entertainment and different forms of art have grown with that growth in population. How would you describe the interest in foreign films today and independent films today versus 1982 when this film society started?
Well, I think it's grown. I mean, I think, you know, as you say, Charlotte's gotten more diverse. It's gotten bigger, and that can't help but change the audience and the hunger. And we have a film this weekend, Mike, this very weekend.
Here comes the plug, everybody. Stand by.
Titled The Mill and the Cross, which I think a lot of you listeners are going to want to see, is an example of what the Charlotte Film Society could bring. It shows at 3 and 7:30 Saturday at Theater Charlotte, on whose boards I think Mike Collins has tread, among other venues in the city. This is a wonderful film based on a painting by an artist named Peter Bruegel, the Elder, and made by a Polish writer and director named Lech Majewski. And it's really an extraordinary film, visually one of the most stunning films I think you'll see in Charlotte this year or any time in the last several years.
Because I haven't seen this, but as I understand it, the painting... this film centers around a painting that was done in the 16th century.
Right, a 16th century painting made by Bruegel. The title of his painting was The Way to Calvary, or The Procession to Calvary. This is Christ moving to his crucifixion. And Majewski, the Polish writer and director, had a long-time personal interest in this painting, and he decided to make a film based on it. And really what he does is make the painting come alive. More than that, he uses really a painter's technique in making a film, which is a very exciting thing to see. Well, he starts from the painting, and the film really has several narrative threads. One is Bruegel actually in the painting, making the painting. So the opening scene, you see him arranging the costumes on some of the characters in the film. Bruegel was known as Bruegel the peasant maker because he painted peasantry at a time when that wasn't done a great deal in art. And so it investigates the life of these peasants living in the Flemish part of Belgium, southern Belgium. And he kind of investigates their life. And the painting, scenes from the painting, are sort of always in the background of the film.
It sounds like Sunday in the Park with George.
It very well could be, based on Seurat's painting. Sure, it's very kind of a similar idea.
Yeah. Well, and also the musical, too. It is very much like sort of the painting sort of comes alive and sort of performs and then goes back. Yeah.
And it's about the process of creating the art.
Yeah, and I think you know, Rich, just to touch upon what Richard said, you know, I think the thing that's really interesting about this particular film is that Bruegel is in the painting. So it is about both about the art and the artist. So there's the art of filmmaking, there's the art of painting, there's the art of sort of, you know, just, I guess, sort of everyday life, which is sort of in there.
To some people, probably not our listeners, but to some people, that may sound fairly esoteric. Is this a film that would be approachable by the average person, or would they just go away scratching their heads?
Nothing blows up in this film, Mike. There are no explosions in this film, Mike.
No car chases?
So,
but I will say, as a quick plug, our second series we have a steampunk kung fu movie playing on Thursday night,
which we'll talk about.
And there plenty of stuff blows up in that movie. So
you didn't answer my question. Yeah. Is it approachable? Would it be approachable?
Oh, absolutely, it's approachable. Absolutely, it's beautiful. You can pick up on the narration and get involved. It has a real kind of a contemporary angle to it because it involves issues of things like terrorism and religious persecution, which are very contemporary topics.
Well, we must take a break or things here will blow up. So, although the audience might like that. Richard Michel is with us along with Jay Morong. We're talking about the Charlotte Film Society and their 30th anniversary and some of the programs coming up. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jay Morong is Programming Director of the Charlotte Film Society. Richard Michel is a retired arts and architecture critic who Rick Thames, who will be a guest in a later program, points out quite vociferously, still writes for us at the Charlotte Observer. And Richard is a longtime contributor to after-film screening talks at the Charlotte Film Society. How do you choose the films that you choose to screen?
Well, we have a committee, and we basically, you know, it's a fairly long, laborious process. But you know, we have a committee. We just look through what are playing in other cities, what are coming out, and then we just sit down and screen them, and one by one, kind of make our recommendations. The three or four of us who are on the committee, we go to film festivals. I was in Toronto this year in September and saw, you know, 40 movies. So we just kind of, and the second part becomes, are these quality films, you know, are they films that we think people will like? But then there is also that second component where, especially for the Saturday Cine Club series, which you got a little taste of with Richard over here, is that, you know, can we find somebody then who will be able to talk about this film with our audience after the screening? So that becomes an issue as well. You know, film may be great, but if there's nothing necessarily to talk about, or there's not a subject we can sort of go down a path and discuss, or people can ask questions, and maybe it's not the right fit for the Saturday Cine Club series anyway.
Why do people need to be able to talk about it in a formalized setting?
Well, I think it is informal. I mean, I think there is a formal leader of the discussion, but it is a very informal discussion.
Does everybody stay, or some people just watch the movie and go?
Some people do leave, but most of the people do stay for our Saturday. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, Mill and the Cross, most people will stay for that. Because, again, I think part of it is they're inquisitive. They don't really know anything about this movie. Mm-hmm. A lot of our members who've been with us for a long time are just there to – they're sort of trusting us. We're bringing it to them, and then they want to know, well, what about this film did I engage with, or they want to talk about that. And I think it's the communal experience. I mean, you talk about how all the, you know, you can get these things everywhere now on Netflix and you know, on your cable system, you can go to Sundance Channel and watch tons of independent movies. But I do think, you know, that communal experience of a membership and talking about it afterwards is really important with these diverse films.
And you use the word quality. I'd like to hear from both of you, because quality is in the eye of the beholder here.
Sure.
What is quality in your mind?
Sure.
And you're a critic, so I expect something big out of you, Richard. What is quality in your mind?
To me, something that is quality, I mean, you're right, it is in the eye of the beholder. I think it has to be challenging. I think it has to be something that's doing something a little different, something that makes you think. It doesn't have to be the most polished film in the world. It doesn't have to be the best acted film in the world. But if it's a film that makes me really start thinking about what is the intention here, what is this artist trying to convey, mm-hmm. I think that to me is a quality film. I mean, because that's the purpose of art. The purpose of art is not to just be amused and then sort of move on. I think you have to stay with you. And so there is something about that for me.
It doesn't have to be beautiful either. A lot of people think art needs to be pretty.
No.
It doesn't need to be pretty. Richard, you're the critic here.
I endorse everything Jay said. I thought it was brilliant. I think it was terrific.
It was quality. That's what he said.
You know, I think one of the things we want from art, you wanted a big statement, Mike, so you're going to get it, darn it.
Okay.
You know, art has the potential to change your life, and that doesn't always happen, but it certainly has happened to me, and I'm sure it's happened to many of your listeners, where they've confronted or been confronted by a work of art, and it's given them a new sense of themselves, a new sense of the world, a new sense of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that art many, many times can do that. I saw recently the paintings by Beverly McIver at the Mint Museum uptown, and I was just nailed to the wall. They're just spectacular. And I think The Mill and the Cross will give a lot of viewers a larger sense of the world. I mentioned earlier that it deals with an issue that's very much a part of our world, and this is religious persecution. And it's not happening in the Middle East. It's happening in Europe, the most civilized Europe, which once had a tremendous problem with this issue, and it's still in parts of Europe still does, and can cause you to reflect on your own beliefs, what you bring to how you conduct yourself in the world. So I think it has the potential to do that. Art has the potential to do that.
I want to get back to the after screening talks, because I know that, Richard, you have a couple of examples of some rousing discussions that have taken place after some of these films. One you mentioned in our pre-show discussion was Hunger, and the other was The Art of the Deal, to name just a few. And you can choose which one you'd like to talk about.
Well, I made a lot of noise at Art of the Deal, which was really a lot of fun, because I was a dissenter. This involved a very wealthy man whether he should keep his paintings and keep them in a certain way. And I was making myself heard in my best New Jersey way that art really belongs to the world and belongs to a larger audience and shouldn't be kind of controlled by one individual. And there was a bit of an older audience there. God, they kept turning around and look at me like, you know, you want to take away our stuff? What are you, crazy? So it was a lively discussion led by my observer colleague, Larry Topman, who, of course, still writes for film, writes about film for The Observer, who's been on this show. So I think, you know, Jay made the point that discussion really extends your enjoyment. I mean, I've been in movies or visual arts performances, performances and visual arts shows where I wanted very much to say, hey, did you see X or did you react this way? And this is an opportunity to do that. I think people appreciate it.
The Film Society has two different series of films. One we've been talking about, that's the Saturday Night Cine Club, which actually has a matinee and an evening.
Yes, so
And then the other is the Back Alley Films series, which is different in that it is geared to younger people. How young?
Well,
or hipper people.
I don't. People. That's more of a lot of the board members like to think it was geared towards younger or hipper people. I just like to think it's a better gateway into foreign and art house films.
How so?
Because it you know, like I talked about, the next film we're showing on Thursday tomorrow is Tai Chi Zero, which is a steampunk kung fu film, but it's a Chinese film and it's a very well made Chinese film, and so. I think the idea with that was to try to engage with a younger audience, college-age students, maybe people in their late 20s or early 30s, who still haven't really sort of made that transgression to kind of open up their artistic viewpoints or their artistic world, to sort of say to them, well, you know, come see something that's a little bit more bizarre, a little bit stranger. You're going to have fun. It's going to be challenging still because most of it's going to be in a foreign language, or it's going to be so transgressive that you're not going to understand the humor.
Is it subtitled or dubbed?
Subtitled.
Okay.
Yeah. Dubbed. Ooh, bad. Naughty word for the Film Society.
I know.
But I think that idea was just to broaden the palette in Charlotte of there's a lot of really excellent bizarre films being made that just are not coming to Charlotte, and so.
The Middle and the Cross, by the way, is not dubbed.
You're not going to give that one
and
up.
I'm not giving up. It's and it stars Rutger Hauer, Michael York, and Charlotte Rampling, who are three.
So it's in English.
Wonderful language. It is in English, yeah. Yes. One of the joys of the film are the other actors, most of whom don't have speaking parts, but. Who have amazingly expressive faces, the posture of their body. And again, I think this is where the director really uses the techniques of the visual arts to really get a sense of place, of time, of people.
The Film Society is a membership organization. You don't have to be a member to see the films, but you get in a little less expensively if you are. Why is it important that this be a membership organization?
I mean, I think part of it is an ownership. I think people need to feel an ownership for what we're doing. We take suggestions from members as to films that they've heard about. You know, they're reading through the New York Times and they come across an article on a film and they say, What's the deal with this movie? Can you get it? There's obviously a cost involved to renting these films, renting the space, paying the speakers. And so therefore that helps us offset some of those costs. But again, I do think it's really just to have a collective experience and to have everybody feel like they are part of that experience. There is a board. We're all, you know, volunteers. We're not paid. And so we want them to feel like they are part. This is theirs because that's how it started.
Do you screen these movies in the same places every month? I know that the Theater Charlotte is going to be the site for Saturday's event.
Yes,
and
the Saturday
Zero is at, as you said, Crown Point Stadium 12 on Monday.
Yeah, the Saturday Night Cine Club is or has been at Theater Charlotte since 2009, I believe. There's a whole history of it. They used to be at the Manor and they used to be other places, but since 2009, we've been at Theater Charlotte for that series. And Crown Point Cinema up on Monroe Road has been our home for the Back Alley series since we started in August last year. And an interesting side note, Rutger Hauer, who was in The Mill and the Cross on Saturday, was also in a Back Alley film series film that we played called Hobo with a Shotgun. So that gives you an idea of the range that Rutger Hauer has as an actor, I guess. You know, he can play Bruegel, and then he can play a hobo with a shotgun.
You've been doing this for 30 years. What kinds of films seem to attract the biggest audience, and has that changed over time?
That question's a little hard for me to answer just because I haven't been with it for 30 years. And again, the types of films that they brought have changed. But I think, without a doubt, what I have seen over the last 7 years since I've been going to screenings or been on the board is French films, without a doubt, you bring a French film in and the audience just rises immensely.
Really?
Oh, it's...
Is it about French films?
I don't know. I mean, maybe because most of them have Juliette Binoche in it. I'm not really sure. You know, you show a movie with Juliette Binoche and it's like, you know, you can't keep enough seats open. But I do think I think there's something maybe with our audience that over the years we've shown so many French films that they've just come to love. And, you know, again, like I said, we have a lot of art house screens in Charlotte, but at the same time, we don't see the amount of foreign films, you know, subtitled foreign films that we maybe even saw 7, 8, 10 Really? Years ago because of the changing, you know, movie theater, you know, bookings.
But at least they're making enough money, these theaters that do screen these independent films, are making enough money to keep doing it.
That is true.
So that's a good sign from your point of view.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, yeah.
Okay. So 30 years, you think 30 years? You have 30 more years left in you guys? Not you, Richard.
Not me.
he's got 30. I can't see why not. This year we've had our largest or second largest, depending on who you talk to, membership base. So it seems like our members are increasing, and it seems like there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to go another 30.
And because it's once a month, how do people find out about what you're screening and where it's going to be?
You can go to charlottefilmsociety.com, or you can go – we have a Facebook page, facebook.com/charlottefilmsociety. Or if you want to send an email to charlottefilmsociety@gmail.com, ask us a question. We'll get back to you.
Jay Morong is programming director of the Charlotte Film Society. Richard Michal is a frequent contributor to the After Film Series Talks and a retired arts and architecture critic for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you both for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The arts seem to get the short shrift in modern society. We've talked about this a little bit in the past. The Daily Paper has a sports section every day. The arts are lucky to get a section once a week, unless that paper is the New York Times. Local TV news has a sports segment in every newscast. They rarely, if ever, talk about the arts. Not to brag, but it is this program, of all the programs on all the stations in town, that seems to devote a regular and significant amount of time to the arts. We believe it is one of our core missions because it is the arts that enrich us as humans. It is the arts that define a culture. It is the arts through which civilizations are remembered long after they have disappeared. But the vacuum created by a lack of arts coverage may be about to change. The Charlotte Arts Journalism Alliance has come into being. That alliance includes WFAE, the Charlotte Observer, UNC Charlotte, and several other area organizations. And we're going to spend the remainder of the hour talking about how and why this alliance has come into existence, what its goals are, how it intends to reach them, and how those of us who are members see this focus on arts journalism benefiting listeners and readers and viewers in the future. We have three board members from CAJA, the Charlotte Arts Journalism Alliance, with us. WFAE's Greg Collard is the station's news director. Good morning.
Morning.
Rick Thames is editor of the Charlotte Observer. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Mike.
And Meg Whalen has held a number of positions at various arts organizations in town and is now director of communications in the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Although you're all board members, I'm told that this is Rick's baby.
Oh, my.
How so? Yeah.
Well, not so much. But, you know, of course, the Observer has for a long time has seen the arts as an important part of our community. We think it enriches our community. And so we have tried very hard to cover the arts as well as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. However, as you look at all of these organizations, they're all interested in this. And we all came to the table saying we'd like to cover the arts better. And we'd like to do it more frequently. Mm-hmm. And so we got together, and the short of it is we applied for a grant with the National Endowment for the Arts and the Knight Foundation. And that grant now has enabled all of us to be more involved in arts coverage. But the point of the grant is innovation in coverage of the arts. The way we're innovating is that we're going to not only be able to produce more arts journalism, but we're going to be sharing it. It's a collaborative effort. And so we believe that as a result of that, more people are going to read about the arts than they ever have before.
The Knight Foundation and the National Endowment came up with a challenge to come up for those of us in the media to come up with new models for arts journalism, the Arts Journalism Challenge. How many recipients? I've read three in one place, five in another. How many other cities are involved in this kind of activity?
There are three cities in all.
Okay, Philadelphia and Detroit.
Are the two other cities where there was a grant. But there were hundreds of proposals across the country. And so Charlotte was one of the three cities. And those three proposals are now going forward.
And from what I've read, the way these three cities are handling this, or taking the challenge grant money that they've gotten from the National Endowment and the Knight Foundation, are very, very different. What's happening in Detroit, what's happening in Philadelphia, what's happening here in Charlotte are very different. Are you going to be looking at the other two cities? Are they looking at us? Will we be borrowing and grabbing and stealing things that seem to work well in those cities as time goes on?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Detroit project was very interesting. Basically, that's a roving video booth that will station itself outside of performances. And as people are exiting the performance, they will be invited to give their own two-minute review of what they just saw. And so that will be posted on a website and probably an app. We think that's a pretty interesting concept. So we'll be watching what they're doing, and a lot of people will be watching what we're doing. Because just like Charlotte, a lot of other cities also have many organizations that want to do more arts coverage, but they need the means to do so.
That's interesting to me, the video reviews, because there's been a lot of hue and cry about how Pauline Kael would not be published today because she was a legitimate film critic, and all people want today are reviews, five stars, thumbs up, thumbs down. Is that a good thing for the arts in 20 seconds to have these populist reviews proliferate?
Well, I think any input is helpful. You just have to come at it and understand the source and take that into account.
We're going to talk some with Greg Collard and Meg Whalen, who are sitting silently here, along with Rick Thames, the Observer editor. When we come back in just a moment to talk more about the Charlotte Arts Journalism Alliance and what it will mean to you. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Rick Thames, the editor of the Charlotte Observer, is with us in this segment, along with Meg Whalen, director of communications at the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte, and Greg Collard, our news director here at WB. Excuse me. Wow. At WFAE. Whoa, now there's a Freudian slip. It's because I'm not wearing headphones. Anyway, we're all here to talk about the Charlotte Arts Journalism Alliance, which is a new effort, a cooperative effort. Name all the partners in this alliance, Greg.
Let's see. Yeah, Charlotte Viewpoint is one. QCity. Metro.com and WCNC TV, in addition to the Charlotte Observer, and of course UNC Charlotte.
So how did all these different entities, that we have a website, we have a publication, we have a television station, we have a radio station, we have a newspaper, we have the university, how did they all come together?
Well,
go ahead. No, I think
it began with really the Arts and Science Council was interested in they hoped there would be some quality proposals that would come from Charlotte when the invitation proposals went out. And so there was a meeting in which a group of people who were interested got together, and that's where we sort of found each other and realized that we were all interested.
But did they want – the entities that are part of this wanted to be – they asked to be part of this, or did we have to seek – did somebody have to go out and seek
Charlotte
them
Observer,
out?
Charlotte Observer called – at least in our case, called us up and I think thought we'd be a good partner with it, and we said, sure, we'd like to –
Yes, yeah, there were probably about four or five of us who are now part of the team that were at this info session. And we all had ideas, and we all had things that we were playing around with that may make good grant proposals for this grant. And so we literally stood outside in the hallway after the info session, and we were just chatting, and we realized that there were a lot of intersections in what we were all independently thinking. And we decided, well, why don't we come together and see what we can do as a unit and try to create a really strong proposal.
So let me begin with WFAE. I know we got some money to put toward this project because nothing is free. It requires staffing and it requires resources. How will that money be spent? What will we hear differently as a result of
this? Well, I hope you've already heard a difference. We are basically going to be having someone assigned to covering the arts. We have five full-time reporters. They do great, and we've always done art stories, but it's sporadic because we're stretched thin. Now we have someone who is kind of a freelancer dedicated, Brianna Duggan. She's dedicated to covering the arts, and we're turning it into a beat, basically. We'll have a lot of the great features that public radio is known for, arts features, but also we'll have some more newsier stories regarding the arts, because I think the arts is a news beat, and we've had since Thursday we started spending some money in this latest round of the grant, and we've had four arts-related stories from a feature on an exhibit at the Mint Museum to more of spot news type stories, like just on for example, a high-stepping band competition at JCSU. Right.
And the innovation here is that those stories will also be available to the other partners. So in effect, we're creating sort of a mini wire service for the arts journalism coverage in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. So now it will be in front of not only the WFAE audience, but it might be in front of the Observer audience and WCNC.
If you find something that we have done at the Observer, you find something that we have done or that Channel 36 has done, you take those scripts and incorporate them into a newspaper story?
In some fashion or another, exactly.
And if Channel 36, which is a television station and requires pictures, find something that you or we have done, what do they do with that information? How do they make it into a television thing?
Well, this, of course, is happening at a time when media is converging. I mean, we use video now on our website,
and most of you do.
And so really,
we're all becoming television stations. That's what's happening here.
We're all, you know, we're on all these platforms, and so it's actually becoming easier as a result of that. Hmm. So actually, I think we will be using a lot of each other's material, and that's where we begin to really magnify this voice and enable more people to learn more about the arts in Charlotte.
What's the university's role or contribution to all of this, Meg?
Well, really, as an educational institution, in the College of Arts and Architecture, we are really interested not only in creating the arts, but in understanding how people receive that, how people interpret it, how people experience the arts. And, of course, that's part of what arts journalism is all about. And so we have partnered in the College of Arts and Architecture with the Department of Communications, and we're really overseeing two things. One is we've created an arts journalism course, which starts in January. It's a spring semester course that draws from both journalism students and arts students. And we're hoping to train, you know, arts journalists, higher quality writers and reporters for radio, TV, whatever, that hopefully will then feed into this system and maybe, you know, provide some material for the CAJA partners. We also are helping to organize a public conference workshop on writing and reporting the arts and culture. That's January 12th at our Center City building here uptown, and it's open to the public, and we're going to address these issues in a very hands-on way and also in a theoretical way.
Newspapers and the Charlotte Observer in particular have always done arts coverage of some sort over the years. The public radio has done a fairly decent job of covering the arts nationally, and WFAE and other stations in local markets around the country do what they can to do this, and this will help us do it even more and even better, I suppose, as time goes on. But television stations, particularly local TV, and to a certain degree the networks, haven't focused on this at all. It's not even on their radar. I think it's interesting that the WCNC has decided that this is something that needs to be covered. What do you, I don't know, there's nobody here to speak for them, so I'll ask you guys to speak for them. Why were they interested in doing this? Because this is a departure for local television.
Well, I'd hesitate to speak for them, but I'll say that, historically, WCNC is a B-low company. Mm-hmm. It has some roots in newspapers.
Right.
And I think it has focused more traditionally on journalism than I think some news stations have. So I think that's part of it. And I think they made a choice. They said, you know, if we have the means to do this, we are going to air more coverage of the arts.
You have said, Rick, that you've been thinking about increasing arts coverage in the paper for a while, and yet that there has never been a, quote, sustainable business model for this kind of content. Why not, and what's changed?
Well, what may have changed is that we found possibly a way to do this, and that is we are looking for underwriting. And for the long term, to sustain this effort, we probably will have to rely on an underwriter to say, here is a way to invest in the arts.
Do we rely on underwriters for sports coverage? This has irked me since I was five, so I've got to ask this question. Do we, and why don't we have to? Why is sports the end-all, be-all of everything? It's in every newspaper. It's on every television newscast. The arts are nowhere.
It's part of our culture. I mean, sports is certainly part of our culture.
But this is culture.
It is, but
this is part of our
go
culture.
Back to what your earlier conversation was about the independent films, and there is support for independent films, but is it sufficient support, you know, to sustain a business model? The question is, I would suggest that no, they're still out there looking for support, and that probably is going to come through underwriting, memberships, that sort of thing.
And this is kind of a chicken and egg thing, it seems to me, because as you pointed out off the air, that The Observer has, I think, four reporters who essentially spend all of their time covering the arts, which includes film and includes, to a certain degree, television. And yet arts groups beg you for coverage, because coverage from you can mean that they sell tickets or they don't sell tickets if they don't get coverage from you. And yet you don't need arts coverage if there's nothing to cover. So it's which comes first, supporting these groups so that they have an audience, or there's something to cover? It puts you between a rock and a hard place, it seems to me.
Well, the people are there. The arts organizations are there. Charlotte has an amazing array of arts organizations out there, as you said earlier, has grown a lot. And what it really needs, what they need, is to for people to know about them.
Have we reached a critical mass where we have where both the media and the arts can benefit each other through coverage of these efforts?
Well, I don't know that. I mean, we certainly have a niche of readers mm-hmm. at The Observer who care a great deal about the arts. It is not as passionate. Well, it may be as passionate. It may not be as broad as sports or business mm-hmm. or general news. But we do have an important niche there, and so it's important to us.
And, of course, public radio has a different business model.
Yeah, and arts coverage has always been important to us, and I think we do a pretty good job of covering the arts through our news department, through Charlotte Talks. But we want to do a better job, but we want a little bit more consistency mm-hmm. with it. I mean, we have Julie Rose and Lisa Miller, our reporters. They do great stories when they can on arts, but they're stretched thin on covering government and education and all kinds of investigations. We can't do everything, and right. and so this allows us to specialize a little bit more. And they'll still be doing art stories, but this is going to enhance what we're doing.
I think another thing too is, you know, and I'm speaking now as a director of communications and having worked in the marketing and publicity world at the Charlotte Symphony. But I think even excuse me, from the arts organizations' perspectives, it's not just about the selling of the tickets or even about knowing we exist. I hope that with an increased focus on arts journalism in Charlotte, we will move beyond that initial, you know, here's an awareness, to try to inspire deeper conversations about the arts. I mean, I think at least from the university's and understanding, yeah. I mean, I think from the university's perspective that we are, of course, interested in bringing greater awareness. These people exist. These organizations exist. These productions exist, whatever. But I think really ultimately what we would like to see is that there is a higher level of discourse about the arts and about our culture here in this city.
And that leads me to this question, which I was going to ask whether we got to it or not. And that is, one of the goals here is to increase both the quantity of coverage and the collaborative nature of coverage, but also the quality of coverage. And so often, and I'm not blaming anybody in particular, it seems to me that a lot of the people that cover the arts don't know what they're looking at. And so how do you make that happen? Because reporters, be they television reporters or radio reporters or newspaper reporters, are reporters. They're journalists. They've learned how to write. They've learned the who, what, where, when, why thing. But they haven't taken a theater class. They haven't been taught to look at movies critically or dance critically or the opera critically. They don't know what they're looking at. So when they write about it, it's virtually useless sometimes.
Well, and that's why the educational component is so important. That's why we believed in. I think that was, in fact, part of what impressed the people who provided us the grant. They realized that we have organizations here that want to cover the arts, but at this point they don't have anyone on their staff qualified to do that, or they have to go out and find someone because they weren't really covering the arts. So UNC comes to play here, and it will be part of the whole exercises to put more people in the field who understand how to write about
it. And the other problem, it seems to me, is not only in the case of the Observer, where you have a Larry Topman who really does know what he's looking at, and you have Stephen Brown, who knows what he's listening to when he covers the symphony and the opera. Then you have the problem of editors who don't necessarily know how important this event is or that aspect of a certain thing is, and you have the reporters fighting for space in your area, airtime in our area, and the editors are going, I don't know, I got other things to put in there. So if you don't educate the editors, can you improve the quality?
Well, that's what part of this is about. I mean, okay. This is about more resources that they avail to those editors.
What are you saying, Mike?
I'm just saying. I'm just don't put it on me.
I think we're recognizing certainly the importance of the arts, and I think it's more than the exhibits. We're recognizing the importance of arts in our community, and we're turning it into a news beat from funding issues. It's more than the exhibits for us and the shows. It's about covering the whole. There, arts is a very expansive term, and we want to cover the funding issues, the different controversies, and cover the exhibits and the good features. This is a news beat too,
and it has an enormous economic impact.
Absolutely.
That people don't even realize the arts in this town have an enormous economic impact in the millions and millions of dollars.
They do, and yet to continue, they have to be noticed.
Right.
And there are so many arts organizations in this city that are getting no notice at all.
Right.
And that, to me, is the most important thing that we're going to do.
Well, one of the goals here is to grow audiences. Why is that the job of media, to help arts organizations grow their audience?
I just think it's important to our audience, and we're interested in good stories and serving our audience, and I think that serves – I think that's our goal in serving our audience. As far as we think the arts is important. I'm a news guy. I just like to cover good stories. Mm-hmm. And I think the arts is part of our culture, and we need to do that. We need to do a better job. As far as supporting, I think that's for other people to answer, or to promoting, I should say.
Meg, you mentioned on January 12th at your Center City campus, which is right down the street. What's it called? You have a whole thing going.
A full-day conference.
Who should attend that? Because you've got sessions on how to be a successful freelancer, Larry Topman from The Observer, who does know what he's looking at, speaking on reviewing the performing and visual arts. Greg is conducting a session on how to write an arts feature for radio. There are other seminars on how to write for the web, how to write for TV, etc. Who should attend this?
Well, I think we're really trying to draw in people from two different categories. One category is the people who are already writers, they're already reporters, they're already doing television and radio pieces, and they really don't know a lot about the arts, and they want to broaden their own areas of expertise in writing. So we do have a session where we're talking about the arts, and we try to infuse each of the sessions with an arts focus, not just a writing focus. The other group are people who are already knowledgeable about the arts, mm-hmm. and may want to try their hand at arts reporting. And so we're hoping to begin to cultivate a group of people in Charlotte who will have both the knowledge about the art form and the knowledge about journalism to create higher quality pieces.
So you're developing a crossover in both directions.
We are, and it's a long-term process. I mean, I think we all need to be clear that we don't expect this to happen in one day. You know, we hope to continue this over a long period.
How will people know what they're looking at, that it's part of the Charlotte Arts Journalism Alliance? Very quickly, 10 seconds.
Each of the pieces will have a designation that it's from Kaja, that cuddly word.
We say it with each story.
Rick Thames, Greg Collard, Meg Whalen, thank you all for being here. Good luck with this effort. It's greatly needed.